Music Now. And today we have in the studio Mr. Donald Fagan, which I have to say is an honor. Thank you for being here, Donald.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, I would start by talking about a song not from your very extensive catalog, but actually a song by The Eels, Dead of Winter.
Mm-hmm.
That's a song that you and I guess your wife posted on Facebook. We posted lyrics in honor of Walter Becker, who we lost very recently. What was it about that song? It's a beautiful set of lyrics, beautiful song. I was struck by that post.
Well, my wife's a huge fan of The Eels, and there was something just, I think, somber and appropriate about it.
Let's hear that for just a moment.
Standing in the dark outside the house, breathing in the cold and sterile air. Well, I was thinking how it must feel.
So, obviously, it's been a lot. How has the weather in your head been this year dealing with this?
Well, at first it was a little stormy when my partner passed on in September. But, you know, it wasn't totally unexpected, I have to say. He was ill for quite a while. And I kind of knew a month or two before that it didn't look good for him. And life goes on.
Yeah.
You're really starting to show off with a bang here.
Yeah, no, it's just certainly is
no,
something.
I understand.
Yeah,
I'm just kidding you.
Yeah. I wish it was a different year, as we all do on every level, I would imagine.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah. To sidestep that for one second, maybe we should go to a song that you actually came out with this year with Todd Rundgren.
Yes.
Called Tinfoil Hat.
Right.
And it's not much of a mystery what this song is about.
No.
It's pretty direct. It's a song about Donald Trump. So I guess obviously you're sharing many people's feelings about the other horrors of this year.
Yeah, you know, I was taking a vacation in on the Hawaiian island of Kauai, where Todd Rundgren has a house, and we're pals, and we were sitting around, and I think it was just after the election, I think, and yeah, we felt we had to, you know, had to vent, so we wrote this tune. Yeah,
this
I was going to call it the Pope of Douche Town, but then we figured Tinfoil Hat was just as good.
Hey, let's hear that for a moment.
He's coming down the escalator with a girl from east of here. He wants to make the country greater.
So here is reality imitating the more grotesque imaginings that you might have had over the years, I have to say. You literally can't make up our new reality, it feels like.
No, actually, it's kind of makes it difficult to write after doing any kind of satire or political satire, because it really outstrips any kind of fiction you might, you know, want to create.
You've also been playing with a young band, the Night Flyers, and you know, it's funny, you've been tough on not only the younger generation but the generation born post 1960. But you know, these guys are 20s, 30s, they're young. What surprised you about the generational interchange there?
Well, you know, these guys are from upstate around Woodstock, New York, in that area, and they're unusual kids. I think they're, you know, into older kinds of music. Connor Kennedy is a really great sort of a prodigy guitar player. And, you know, we've been hanging out the last couple of years. And so I wanted to do some of my own material. And since, you know, I knew these guys and I had seen them play, it seemed like a good idea to take these guys out. And they're just fantastic, you know. I don't think they're the average millennial bears.
I think at least one of them might have said that there's been talk of maybe recording with them. Has that been something in your head?
Yeah, well, yeah, I've been sending Connor some tunes that I've been working on. And yeah, I'd love to do that.
And now the idea is clearly, as you said in your statement, to continue on with, quote, the Steely Dan band.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there's a legal entanglement that you're in that I presume, like with many legal entanglements, can't be spoken of too much. But do you imagine that's going to be any impediment? Do you see any problem proceeding?
No, not really. I mean, it's one of these things where, you know, years ago, really decades ago, when we started the band, Walter and I had a contract, and it was a really simple thing that a lot of bands have. It's just as if someone is resigns or is fired or dies, they sell their stock, their rock and roll stock, I guess, back to the company. So we signed this thing, and the idea was that, it ended up to be just Walter and I were the remaining partners, and, 50-50 partners. And the idea was that, you know, if somebody dies, that, you know, the other guy would essentially run the band and take control of the band and all that kind of stuff. So we're just trying to defend the that contract.
The original contract, right.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Steely Dan, except, you know, perhaps at the very beginning, was not so much a band as a sort of entity. Its very nature was always fascinating to me, that it was, you know, it was you and Walter, and after the first couple albums, and, you know, whoever you felt could play the songs best.
Yeah, it started as a band.
Of course, yeah.
But after, you know, a couple tours on the road, Walter and I weren't really having that much fun on the road in those days. The conditions were harsh, and we were opening for a lot of heavy metal groups and so on. It wasn't ideal. So we decided to just record, and of course the other guys wanted to go out and play, so you know, basically we dissolved that particular band and then started working with studio musicians, because we started as staff writers out in LA for ABC Dunhill Records. They had their own studio, like, built into this building, this the ABC building, so we would get to see all these great studio players come in and do tracks, you know, starting 9 o'clock in the morning for they do jingles, they do TV themes, but the musicians were amazing. You know, Jim Gordon was often playing the drums, and Michael Omarion was playing the piano and so on. So mm-hmm. we got to know these guys, and we said, hey, let's bring these guys in to play.
I mean, the funny thing is, in my estimation, that original band was, although you have many unhappy memories of touring and the live shows, there's some documentation of that original band smoking live. That record plant bootleg is fantastic.
Yeah, we got pretty good towards the end of it, actually. You know, they were all good players, and I think it took a leap when Mike McDonald joined the band as a second singer and keyboard, and it was great to be playing with him.
Just as a quick side note, while we're in this era, there's the famous / infamous spoken intro to the live version of Bodhisattva.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, is one of the funniest things that's ever been put on record. Maybe we can hear that.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We're glad you made it here tonight, because you're going to miss out. You can tell your friend tomorrow that they gonna miss out on a damn good thing we gonna give you tonight. And one thing I can tell you, brother, he is here tonight. Mr. Magnificent One is here. The beautiful one is here. You little old pretty one, she here too. You know, whatever. Here is the Magnificent One, the one and only one, Mr. Steely Dan and whatever.
That was your bus driver?
No, actually he was one of the truckers.
Okay.
He drove the one of the semis, that, you know, full of equipment. And his name was Jerome Anatone. I don't know what's become of him. But one night he asked if, you know, he could introduce us, and he was pretty happy by about showtime every night. And he would announce the show every night, and that one happened to be recorded.
He didn't really know the name of the band or who was who. He thought your name was Steely Don or something. Was that?
Or Stevie Dan.
Steve, right.
Yeah, he wasn't exactly sure who he was working for. There's a story about him. Once he was, you know, I guess an alcoholic, essentially. And they have these big loading docks when you go into a venue, with the door that opens vertically, the sort of corrugated doors, you know, and he once just he didn't wait for the door to open completely and just ran the truck in and it sheared the top of the truck off.
That's fine work there. His MC skills though were
it was excellent.
Unparalleled. Yeah,
excellent. He could have been a DJ before there were DJs.
So the other thing that you said over the years was you guys figured out if you didn't have a band, no one could make you tour. Is that a joke, or was that part of the literal thinking there?
Well, maybe unconsciously.
Do you remember sitting down with Walter and actually having that discussion of it doesn't have to be a band anymore, it could just be us, and we could... Do you know what I mean? Was it a conscious sit-down kind of decision?
The way I remember it was we were in London, I remember, and we did a couple shows at the Rainbow, and they went well, but then I got sick. Like, I had some kind of really bad laryngitis. So we all came home from that, and then we did a few more gigs on the West Coast, and, you know, both of us were really worn out from the, you know, sort of style of touring we were doing in those days, and we both said, you know what, we're going to die if we can keep doing this. And let's after the next record, let's just try to talk the president of the company, this guy Jay Lasker, a big cigar smoking entrepreneur, if we could just, you know, record records. And he was fine with it as long as they sold. And in fact, you know, after we stopped touring, the sales, of course, rose great. They were inflated. So, you know, maybe it was better that we didn't tour.
One of the things that also afforded you, of course, was an ability to achieve ever greater levels of sort of technical achievement and perfection, both sonic and musical. Walter, probably post Everything Must Go, or maybe even a little earlier, he had gotten a little sick, he said, of perfectionism and chasing that thing, which was fascinating to me because that's sort of part of the very essence of what people think of as Steely Dan. And I'm not sure you ever got sick of it.
Yeah, I think we were both getting a little tired of the difficulty of making those kinds of records. Although I don't think we were ever truly like perfectionists. I don't think we thought of ourselves as, we just wanted the record to sound professional, like big band jazz records, you know, like,
right,
clean, you know, good clean playing. And but I think maybe it's true we did go overboard, and by the last record in the 70s called Gaucho, we may have you know, just went past it a little bit.
I think that's what I love about that record. But yeah,
I like it too. You know, maybe there were some live playing on that record, certainly, but there could have been more, I think.
Not to sound like when in your Ennio Morricone interview when you're presenting him with theories and he just grunts, but there's a certain unity, perhaps unintentional, between the themes of that record and the arguably overlabored music. It actually mm-hmm. works, and it works very well together.
Yeah, but, no, I think it turned out to be a thing. That's for sure, yeah.
There's so many great stories about the lengths that you guys went to. I mean, one, of course, is Wendell, which mm-hmm. was a drum machine so primitive. There's a story that someone had to type into the machine for 5 to 20 minutes to get maybe one bar or something like
well,
that.
Well, yeah, this was in the early days of digital recording and digital sampling and all that. And we were having trouble getting a track, and forget which one.
Hey 19, actually.
Hey 19, yes. Maybe, yeah. And so our engineer, Roger Nichols, who was a brilliant guy and had been working with computers for years before anybody else was. And he, I remember we said, you know, that Roger Lynn drum machine, you know, it's not good enough. It's too bad. It's wasn't full frequency recording. It was like, you know, low sample rate. And also, you know, you couldn't really manipulate the beats that much. So I wish we had a machine that could, you know, it's just as full frequency as the digital machine we're using. And Roger said, yeah, I can make that. I think I can build one of those. He says, all I need is about $200,000. So we had about $200,000 left in our budget. Like, that was like half the budget or something. And we just gave him the money. And then we knocked off for 3 weeks. And then he came in with this machine, you know. But it was, as you say, it was primitive compared to what they have now. It was, he had to type in the bytes themselves, you know, a list of bytes to get a sound out of it. And, like, I remember he said, this symbol or whatever lasts too long for the memory. There's not a, he says, I got to wait till till September. So he said, well, what's happening? He says, well, that's when Intel is coming out with a better chip. And so finally, you know, after a while, we could finally record, you know, long things. But it was very laborious and boring and stupid.
Well, I mean, what always
amazed me. But it worked.
Yes,
it did work.
And it sounds great. But
yeah, it did work.
But at the same time, you had access to literally any drummer in the world.
That's true. And although we always, you know, we were sort of scrupulous about it, we'd always try to do a track first live.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes we'd get it. And if we didn't, we'd take a sample from the track we just recorded and credit the drummer who played it.
I mean, at the same time, something like the title track of Asia, I mean, that's Steve Gadd, I think, on the first take.
Yeah.
Or second, maybe.
Yeah, we did two takes. I think we edited first and second take together, yeah.
So when appropriate, you were very happy to use something.
Yeah, you know, it's whatever works. You know, it was our philosophy.
He goes around to drum clinics still showing people how to play those fills, that solo, you know.
You know, we just set him loose. There was we had a long chart. It was like 8 pages or something that I had come up with Larry Carlton helped me to put it together. And it was taped onto his stand, and he just, there was a part where it just said drum solo. And he just, he did, and that's what he did.
He obliged. He provided the drum solo.
Yeah.
And we'll hear that for just a moment. One of the things that, you know, people struggle to understand for years and maybe can never understand, having not been inside the partnership, is just sort of who did what, how it worked. It's a question you could probably answer in an entire book, which maybe you'll actually write one day. But what insight can you provide about the nature of the songwriting and production partnership?
Well, you know, we just get together at either his apartment or my apartment, or when we're in California, we have rented houses. But and I'd, you know, be at the piano, and, you know, I'd have some ideas, or he'd have some ideas, and he would have a bass, a guitar, or something, and we'd just kick it around, and whatever was the funniest thing we could think of, that we started working on that, you know, whatever seemed really, like,
both musically and lyrically, kind of.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, we wanted the music to be good so that it wasn't just a pastiche or something like, or a straight parody. We had, you know, because we were jazz fans, we had certain standards, but, you know, it had to sort of, you know, pass for straight, even though we knew it wasn't. You know, it was like, because we didn't want the humor to be broad. You know, we wanted it to be nuanced.
So you're listening to Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm in the studio with Donald Fagen. I'm Brian Hyatt, and we'll be right back.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
The first of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Our house is a mess. Come on in.
I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian, and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
So, Don, we were talking a little bit about how the partnership on a songwriting and production level worked with Walter, and you said whatever made you laugh the most is kind of what you went with. In your book, when you described your first songwriting sessions together, you said you basically end up rolling on the floor, just cracking each other up.
That's true. I guess, we were kids, you know, and it was just... problem is we couldn't really take it that seriously, I suppose. You know, we admired, we were big fans of the Byrds, I remember, and Frank Zappa, and couldn't take anything seriously, apparently. But you know, we loved Motown and soul music and blues and so on. But when we'd start writing, it would just get out of hand, you know. And yeah, Walter, I think, used to get more out of hand than I did, and I'd have to sort of bring him back a little bit so it wouldn't be too ridiculous.
At the same time, I think you said that your ideas tended to be on a lyrical level more on a fantasy level, and that he would come more from observation of life.
I think that's fair. I read a lot of science fiction when I was a kid. He did too. But I was sort of, I liked the kind of science fiction that commented on the present by kind of extrapolating from the present and you know, creating a future that would kind of bring out certain things about the present that in a funny way. And Walter was, I think he had greater powers of observation. Like he was, observing people, psychology. He was really, he could have, I think if he wanted to, he could have been a novelist or short story writer if he had the patience.
You've written great nonfiction. You don't think that you could have done the same if you'd had the patience?
No, I can't write fiction. I've actually given it a try once in a while. It's just not my, it always has to be grounded in some real thing. I can write essays, but not fiction.
You guys had a lot of similarities. You also had, major differences in your sort of backgrounds. So Walter, had a, as you said, rough childhood. His dad died when he was 16. His mom was out of the picture. It was not smooth sailing. Whereas you grew up bored eventually when you moved to a part of New Jersey you hated, but with a stable family.
Yeah, my family was relatively stable. Yeah, for sure.
I mean, how did those differences play themselves out in your estimation?
Well, I think I got to see, at close range, what can happen, I think, to somebody if the parenting isn't really there. And, he gave him a lot of problems. I think he was very insecure. As time went on, he had some, drug problems. And I think people who are either have abusive parents or parents who give mixed messages, whatever, or aren't there, it is more difficult in a way because they, unless someone else comes in to take their place, their center is wavy, their core. And and I think it's very painful on some level that, perhaps I don't even understand. And so that I think that's why a lot of, I think people in that situation end up, trying to medicate themselves or have, various other problems.
You've written of your own issues with anxiety and such, but this forced you, I guess, to be the saner member of the partnership.
For the most part, we supported each other, I think. It's like, I went through my own stuff too sometimes, and he was great. But, he certainly had his share of problems.
What's incredible is it's now, and sad of course as well, but it's now a body of work, what you guys did together. There's a beginning and an end, at least on a recorded level. And it doesn't just encompass the Steely Dan records. There's soul records that you guys actually worked on together in some form. I mean, are you satisfied with what came from the partnership? Did you eke out
enough? You mentioned body of work. I remember when we won a album of the year at the Grammys. I remember Walter said something, we weren't being applauded for our body of work, but rather for our bodies that work. Which were, we were getting on at that time.
Is it too soon for you to be able to look back and say, well, we did this much together,
Yeah, I think we did pretty well. I think, I'm not really that interested in stuff that I've done. I'm always sort of, I'm always working on something, not always with great success, but I'm always more interested in what I'm doing presently than the old stuff. And, other people have to judge it if it, was any good.
Any regrets that you didn't get another Steely Dan record out together?
Yeah, kind of. Walter, he had some health problems and especially after maybe 2011, 12, he I felt that, you know, I think just being ill for so long, he had a little bit of a personality change, and he was much more isolated, I think, and so on. And he kind of, he wasn't that interested in working on Steely Dan records anymore. And it also might have to do with what you were speaking of. I think he, you know, the specter of doing an album that would, you know, be on the same standard that we did previously. I mean, you know, maybe that scared him a little bit. Or maybe he didn't feel he had the energy.
Yeah, and it's right. I mean, and that's something, you know, when you talk to people who've done amazing things already, that does loom. Like, you know, you're going to be judged by that standard, and that can be, you know.
Yeah, it didn't really bother me that much, but I think he had a thing about it. And yeah, it's true. Like, because I did ask him once in a while if he wanted to do something, and he'd usually say, yeah, sure, but then, you know, he wouldn't call me, or, you know, whatever. So it's obviously he's lost some of the enthusiasm.
Obviously, there was a period when you guys fell out of touch before the reunion in the 90s. You guys got back together actually way before, of course, before the comeback album. And then what people don't really have a sense of, and, you know, it's your business to a certain extent, but, you know, the sort of ebb and flow of the relationship in the 2000s, besides that little bit of distancing in this decade, was it an ebb and flow, or were you guys pretty close, or how did it all kind of work?
Well, you know, I think after we got back together in, I guess, in the early 90s, yeah. You know, we both had families at that point, and like a lot of other groups, you know, you don't see each other as much. You have, you know, responsibilities and so on, or children or whatever. So, you know, it wasn't like when we were kids. But, you know, we were always friends, and, you know, except for maybe the last couple of years when I think because of his health, he was more isolated. We were always like, every time we'd talk, we'd still be laughing. So, and it was always fun.
A friend of his told one of my colleagues that Walter was like actually drinking again in the 2000s.
I said he wasn't a big drinker, as far as I know. I remember seeing him having, you know, some wine once in a while, but that wasn't
an issue.
It wasn't a big thing, as I remember.
Did you?
He was more into opiates.
On a continuing basis?
No, intermittently.
Not to ever compare you to Mick and Keith. You know, I know that Mick was, it's a hard comparison to draw, but I know that Mick sometimes, you know, people love Keith and worship his sort of, you know, pushing it to the edge lifestyle, but it can be very frustrating to be Mick and have to deal with Keith. I don't know if it was
and vice
ever,
versa, I'm sure.
Good point. Yes. Were you ever sort of Mick in that scenario where you're trying to keep it together? And,
you know, I remember sort of these brief periods in when we were touring in the early 70s. I think, you know, he hated touring then, and he, you know, he became a little hard to deal with then. And I remember having a talk about it, and then he was cool, you know, for years afterwards. And then, you know, there were a few other periods where I felt I should talk to him.
Things did fray during Gaucho, and not just because of the sort of perfectionism, or however you would phrase it.
Yeah, he was in a really bad situation in the end of the 70s. That's true.
What were the musical differences, if any, between your sort of tastes, and what sort of sounds or approaches or whatever was more him or more you, if that can be teased out at all?
It's hard to say. I think maybe if someone listens to his solo records, which I love, and my solo records, I think that's probably the best way to tell. Although we were very much of one mind for the most part, I think, generally speaking. Like, you know, when I first met him, he, I just heard the songs he had written when he was 17, 18. They were maybe folkier. He had weird chords, but a lot of it was guitar-based. I would say more, kind of, you know, New York folky. And I think I was already starting to put more, like, jazz harmony into it, and, you know, so on. But it didn't seem to be a problem. We just, you know, used a little of his stuff and a little of my stuff, and we just kind of, the songs just grew like excrescences, you know.
The use of, you know, fantastic and sometimes incongruous theoretically jazz chords in rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
One time you guys cited Laura Nero as an influence on that. Is that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I remember Walter at school, he had sharing a dorm, a very large dorm room with a roommate, and he had these huge Altec speakers, studio monitors, these used studio monitors he had bought on the floor. And I remember once he said, "Hey, you got to hear this." And we went up, and he had this Laura Nero record. That was the one that had, it had a song, Chambers, Walls of Heartache.
Mm-hmm.
And we were amazed by that record because it used a lot of stuff from modern music, Hindemith and Bartok, type of chords with triads with the wrong bass note and stuff like that. Plus she had a way of mixing it in with blues and Motown type stuff that was fantastic. And I think that we started to become more experimental after hearing that and a few other things.
Without doing a music theory lesson for our listeners, there's a chord that you guys named the Mu major. If people heard it, they would recognize it. Do you remember how that became such a signature for you guys, or where you possibly stole it from?
Yeah, that's we certainly didn't invent.
No,
that.
No, it goes back to the 13th century or whatever.
Probably does. Yeah. And there's certain pops like Stephen Sondheim, uses that chord all the time. Yeah, it was just I think part of my piano style. If I'm harmonizing something, I'll just naturally go to that kind of harmony, that kind of chord. And I remember our guitar player in the 70s, Denny Diaz. He wasn't used to playing that on the guitar, so we Walter found all the voicings that you could play on the guitar of that one thing. Some of them apparently were impossible to play unless you had seven fingers or something. And we wrote a little sort of treatise on the chord, which we called the Mu major chord, and basically to try to prank guitar players who thought that maybe they were missing something.
There's been people breaking their fingers trying to play these chords.
Was a terrible thing to do. And we were kids.
It's the keyboardist revenge on guitar players.
Yeah.
Walter was, a fantastic bass player, mm-hmm. a killer lead guitarist, among other things, but he wasn't always excited about playing, on records or, even sometimes live. What was that about? One of your engineers, Elliot Shiner, said he was always confused why he didn't play more.
Yeah, I was too. It goes back to a certain kind of insecurity. He's a great player, but for some reason he was just didn't have confidence. As time went on, he became more confident about his playing. But I'd certainly always encourage him to play because I loved his touch and his ideas were amazing.
You're a keyboard player. Playing though has always been kind of close to the center, and it's often simple parts for all the complexity. It's often you're kind of just playing the chords, essentially. Mm-hmm. There's no particular interest in showing off on your part.
No, I mean, I do have, I think, certain limitations to my playing, but it's. I think just my role is more of as a rhythm player. Sometimes in live, I'll give myself a solo once in a while or something like that, but on records. I don't know. There's, rock and roll, it's kind of underwhelming sometimes to hear a piano piano solo, at least in the style I play, which is some kind of single note, right hand, bebop-y style. It sounds a little weak sometimes with the other instrumentation, So I guess I just haven't. Sometimes I've done some things on synthesizer that I think fit in better.
You once thought about applying, supposedly, to be in Bob Dylan's touring band or auditioning. Wouldn't that have been dull for you, given the kind of chords and simplicity of his music?
No, because I think if you listen to the way, for instance, Richard Manuel plays Bob Dylan songs, they're not boring at all. He has a lot of gospel flourishes and what you call added note harmony, like the Mu major.
Right.
Something like that. So I think, you know, if I did it, it would be more along those lines, maybe more even, you know, with a little more jazz stuff in it. And I think it would work.
Want the gig, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Like, he seems to have, he's got his voice back, sounds like to me, a little bit.
I'm hearing that too. It's maybe
the
Sinatra
thing. How that happened.
Well, he's got a voice back.
He's got one of his voices back.
Yeah. You always seem dubious about your own singing. Have you ever grown to a level of comfort with your voice?
Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah, it's I've had some coaching along the way, and it's much easier to sing now than when I didn't know how to sing at all.
Is there a voice you wish you had?
Well,
Ray Charles,
maybe, or, you know, I just don't consider myself a great singer for sure, but I do the best I can. I think the thing that gets me by is for the kind of stuff we write, I have the right attitude.
Attitude, yeah,
and that's just as important, I think, in rhythm and blues and rock music.
I've somehow found a thing where I go to YouTube and I watch people attempt to cover Steely Dan songs.
Yeah, that's usually a pretty sad experience.
A lot of people attempt Josie, which is interesting.
Well, I call it the Bill Murray effect.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, when he on SNL, when he used to do lounge versions of Star Wars, things like that. That's what it sounds like to me.
We were talking about, you know, what Steely Dan is, and now you already have played shows without Walter.
Mm-hmm.
So is that, in your mind, is that still Steely Dan, or is it you fronting the Steely Dan band who used to be Steely Dan? I mean, you know what I mean? How do you see that as what the thing is without him?
Yeah, well, I would actually prefer to call it, you know, Donald Fagen and Steely Dan Band or something like that. We got a lot of flack from Live Nation, not to put too fine a point on it, about calling it Steely Dan. And, that's an ongoing debate.
Wait, in other words, they want you to call it Steely Dan for commercial reasons, or you mean they do want you?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. It just sells better, yeah.
There's suits, you know.
It feels more like the other thing you said to you.
To me, it does, because to me, Steely Dan was just me and Walter, really. It was like a concept that we had together. And it doesn't, it's no big thing to me either way, frankly. But I think in my mind, it's Steely Dan was me and Walter. I'm hoping I could persuade these people to let me do what I want, as far as that goes.
Did you get to have the final conversation or conversations with him that you would have wanted to have?
Well, that's a... it's kind of, you know... When I heard he was really ill, I was on the road in, I think, Salinas, Kansas. And I flew back. I had a day off. And he was in his apartment in New York, and I was really glad that I went. You know, it was like I could see he was really struggling. But you know, it's like he like when I put a chair next to the bed, and he like grabbed my hand, and it was like something has never done ever before.
Wow.
And we had a great talk, and you know, he was listening to hard bop. His wife had on a Dexter Gordon record or something like that, and he was still very funny, even though he was very weak. And I'm you know, really glad I had those hours. You know, it was important, I think, to do that. You know,
you had to go out and play, of all things, stadium gigs at a big festival while this was going on without him.
Yeah, it was very weird, you know, not having him there. We got through it. And then we had these gigs booked in October after that. So, I did it. And after a while, it didn't seem as strange, you know, after a couple of weeks. And, you know, it'll always feel a little weird, you know. I mean, it's always going to feel that way. But, you know, I think I can handle it, you know.
And how long do you... doesn't seem like retirement or anything like it is in the offing. How long do you want to be a touring musician and keep... Mm-hmm. Got the Night Flyers, Steely Dan Band, so there's a... possibly mm-hmm. recording. There's a lot.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I feel good. You know, I'm going to be 70 in January, but I'm feeling really good. You know, I try to, you know, do enough exercise to keep myself from falling apart.
You know, like, what do you do? What's your...
I go swimming a couple times a week, and you know, sometimes floor exercise and things like that. But
have you stayed on the
cigarettes? I'm not like one of those. I don't try to get ripped or anything. That's never going to happen. You know, you know, I try to keep myself going.
Do you want to keep touring, like, just pretty much as long as you physically can?
Yeah, you know, it keeps you young, for sure, touring. I notice, like, when I'm off, I don't feel as good as when I'm on. You know, if I'm, I got to be either recording or touring, and I especially enjoying live performance more than I used to, because we have a fantastic band. I got a couple of fantastic bands, and it's just so much fun to be with these guys and to play, you know?
And finally, you know, there are, if anyone who's read your tour diary with the Dukes of September would get a pretty jaundiced view of the current state of society, among other things.
Yeah, it really wasn't about the tour. Yeah. It was really about just traveling through the world as it is, in a certain way.
And I think everyone who wasn't already feeling the same way as you is after this year, pretty much, any thinking human. But is there anything that you see on the cultural or political or whatever horizon that gives you hope?
Well, you know, actually, the this Alabama thing that happened, I think, you know, it was a small thing, I think, but it was, there was something hopeful about the fact that in Alabama, they're not so jaded and jaundiced that they would actually, like, elect a, you know, a big douche like that guy, you know, to the Senate. I mean, really.
Yeah.
Give me a fucking break, man. You know, it's got to stop somewhere, you know.
Well, so this has been Rolling Stone Music Now. We've been lucky enough to have Donald Fagen in the studio. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For being here and for all the years of music, to be sappy for a moment. And we will be back next week at 1 p.m. here on Vium, Sirius XM 106. In the meantime, download us as a podcast, subscribe to us as a podcast, and leave us a nice review if you can. Come on, we got Donald Fagen on. Come on.
Yeah, baby.
And we'll see you next week. Thanks again, Donald.
Thanks.